feel a little warm, more tired than usual, congested, and maybe even a little achy. At this point, you might ask yourself, is it worth going to work? Or perhaps your child looks pale and complains of an upset stomach. Do you let him or her stay home from school? Are you putting others at risk by going to work or sending your child to school or to daycare? I'm Matthew Law Middleton, and on today's Central Standard, we look at this kind of simple question, which, according to the Integrated Benefits Institute, costs U.S. employers over $500 billion annually. That plus will hit some of the best things you can do to make a speedy recovery. Joining me to explore the sniffles, fevers, and chills, and worse, are Dr. Catherine Satterwhite. She's the senior epidemiologist with the Kansas City Health Department, and she's assistant professor in preventative medicine and public health department at KU Medical Center. Good morning, Catherine.
Hi.
And then we also have family nurse practitioner Joy Roberts, who's also the assistant dean at the School of Nursing here at UMKC. Good morning, Joy.
Good morning.
So, you know, to be honest with you guys, I'm not feeling 100% myself today. Yesterday I was about at like 85%. I've had a sore throat, a little bit of congestion. And, you know, this morning I'm doing actually a little better than I've been doing. Say 90-95%. Should I even be in work today, Joy? Am I?
Well, you know, one of the things that we want to have people always think about is how they feel. Because if you feel bad and you feel sick, then that should be your guide to whether you should stay home or not. Just like your mom told you when you were a child and you said, I have a sore throat or I don't feel good. And she said, well, we'll have you stay home and drink warm liquids and rest and maybe take a little Tylenol or a little decongestant. And then you would feel better the next day and you could go on to school. That's what you should do to treat yourself as an adult as well. So I maybe should shake my finger at you for coming to work yesterday when you were 85%. As you are feeling somewhat better now, I would encourage plenty of liquids. Make sure you wash your hands. Don't breathe on your coworkers and encourage them to wash their hands and not touch anything you've been touching.
Well, that puts a lot of the office, I suppose, at risk. Catherine, when you're studying diseases at the Kansas City Health Department, what kind of illnesses are you looking at? What are you tracking?
So in the winter, we see two primary illnesses. The first, and these are the two that we're probably concerned about when we think about workplace health and school health. The first is the common cold. Most adults get 2 to 3 colds a year, most adults and most children. So it's something that we generally see peak in the winter, earlier in the winter. The flu is something that we're also concerned with, and that tends to peak a little bit later around February. And those are the two types of illnesses that we see at this time of year. But luckily, they have pretty similar prevention messages.
And But like until this moment right now, like I wasn't counted, right? My primary care provider, I didn't go to her or him to, you know, let them know, oh, I'm feeling just a little under the weather. Do you guys make like estimates? How do you guys begin to count and figure
right
out what's going on?
So that's a complicated question, but I'll try to give you a simple answer. The short story is for something like the flu, that's one of the easier things to do. We estimate based on the number of people who do actually see their doctor, who do go to the emergency room, and what we look for is what we call flu-like illnesses. And we use those to sort of estimate what the flu looks like in the current season. The other thing we can do sometimes is we'll do surveys of people and ask them how they're feeling at that particular point in time, and we can use that to estimate as well.
Mm-hmm. And so what are the contagious diseases right now that you folks are most concerned about?
I'm not aware of any particular diseases that we're focusing on right now. Mm-hmm. One of the biggest things we're concerned at the health department, as well as at KU, are making sure that people are prepared for the flu season. So one of our biggest things that we're emphasizing right now is the importance of a flu shot. You know, some people have a little bit of reluctance in getting a flu shot, but it's important to remember that of all the things you can do to protect yourself, getting a flu shot is still the single best way to protect yourself from the flu.
Did I already miss that window, though?
No, you didn't. In fact, you can get the flu shot all the way up through March or even April. But ideally, we'd like to have people get it as soon as possible because, like I said, the flu peaks in February. Mm-hmm. So we'd really like to have people get it before then and, if possible, to get it at their first opportunity. And luckily, there are lots of places you can get the flu shot.
it hasn't been around forever, the flu shot. It's kind of, you know, a last decade or two that we've been using it roughly, right?
That's a good question. I don't know that I could tell you exactly when we started, but I would say probably a little bit longer than that. Mm-hmm. I would say the past two or three decades. Joy can correct me if she knows anything else.
Yeah, Joy.
And actually, I would agree. It was around in the mid to later 80s when we started really encouraging everybody. Prior to that, when flu shots were available, we were encouraging people who were really at risk of serious consequences if they were to contract the flu. So people who were being treated for major illnesses, really young children with lung disease. But by the late 80s, we were really strongly encouraging everyone
to roll it out. Yeah, Catherine.
That's right. And those groups that we had initially recommended the flu vaccine for are still groups that are incredibly important when we talk about who it's most important for to get the flu shot. We think about young children and we think about elderly adults, those aged 65 and older.
Mm-hmm. And has it been, it's been around for several decades now. Does it work? Like, are we noticing less people taking time off or are there other things at play?
So every year we estimate, CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, estimates how effective the flu shot is. So this year we don't have estimates yet, obviously, because we're early in the season. Last year, I believe the estimates were 50 to 60%. And usually they run about there, about maybe 50 to 70% effective. And most people say, well, that's not very good. But you have to remember, that's no effort on your part. That's not you remembering to wash your hands or cover your cough or stay away from people who have a cough. That's getting one shot. So it's while it's not as effective as maybe some of the other vaccines, it's still a good shot.
Mm. And so, Catherine, I want to take just a little bit of a step back. I know there are countless infectious diseases out there, you know, both bacteria and viruses, and they transmit in a lot of different ways. But can you kind of take me through the story of a parasitic organism in my body and what it's doing and when I start to feel sick?
Sure. So I'll use influenza and the common cold as examples because they are a little bit different. So with a cold, so that's usually caused by something called a rhinovirus. And common colds are caused by viruses. So that's actually an important thing to remember. So don't go asking your doctor for antibiotics. But getting back to the common cold. So the common cold is something that sort of slowly develops over time. You might start feeling a little scratch in your throat. You might get a little bit of a runny nose. And then you kind of ramp up with your symptoms. And it's important with a cold to remember that that's kind of, you're also infectious then. So as you start to notice symptoms, you need to think about what Joy said in terms of when you might stay home to really start your body healing.
Yeah, but I find like that's the rub. Like, the worst part is like when I'm actually feeling like, oh, I can just
go to
work. You
can tough it out.
Well, not only that, but like, you know, I don't want to, I think there's a perception of guilt that like, oh, I'm staying home and like I feel pretty fine, you know, like, and then I just spend the day watching television or reading. And, you know, like, was that the right step? You know, was I making a conscious decision that actually helps my employees and myself in the long run?
And I think the biggest thing to remember is it's not just you. So you might feel that you need to suck it up in a sense and go to work and do your thing, but you have to remember that you're exposing other people. So if you actually are ill, you are now putting everyone that you're coming into contact into risk. So in terms from an employer perspective, it's better for you to stay home and to prevent the spread of illness to other people. Now, and that's obviously a difficult thing to balance because you do want to do your job, but you also have to remember that you are part of an organization that you also need to think about when determining whether you should stay home.
Joy?
And I was going to add that I am frequently asked this by patients that I see, and I strongly encourage them to take a day or two off to recover from their illness, to avoid spreading it. And I have to remind them, this is why you have sick days or vacation days that can be taken for sick days. And yes, I know everybody wants to hoard their vacation days for fun, but you've got to take care of yourself and you will shorten the duration of your illness instead of spending the next 10 days slogging to work feeling awful and then having all of your coworkers angry with you for having infected them. You take 2 days off. You tell yourself, I'm not going to feel guilty. And very frequently, I actually will write work excuses, even if it's a regular patient of mine, without having seen them, if they will drop by and I see that runny red nose and hear the hoarseness in their voice, and I'll give them a work excuse. Yes, they're sick. They need to take a day or two off to feel better.
Catherine?
I think one thing that I think about, so I have a six-year-old and a four-year-old, and we talk a lot about the golden rule. Treat others as you would like to be treated. And I think that that's a perfect thing to remember when thinking about whether you should stay home from work. Would you prefer that someone else stayed at home if they were in your situation?
Mm-hmm. So moving forward a little bit. So even though I'm not feeling 100%, you know, I take that day off to recuperate. But let's say that just doesn't work, you know, and I get progressively more sick. Are you saying that, like, by the time I'm feeling really crummy, I've missed the window that I might as well just be at work even when I'm in, like, the feeling the worst? No, stay home.
No, you need to stay home.
And I've seen this a number of times in the U.S., but I think I believe it's a more common widespread practice in a number of Asian countries where people will wear surgical masks throughout the day when they're not feeling 100%. The idea being that's kind of a courtesy to their neighbors and the general public to not spread disease. Is there any kind of scientific support to that behavior, or is it just kind of a nice way of indicating, like, I'm thinking of others while I'm out and about?
I don't know if there's been large studies that have examined that. However, it is something that in particular we recommend to medical professionals. If they feel that there's any risk that they might expose their patients, it's part of what we call universal precautions. It goes along with wearing gloves, wearing a face mask. So if there's any risk of transmitting to a patient, we see that occasionally with medical professionals. But you're right, it's certainly less common here in the United States.
You're listening to KCUR and Central Standard on KCUR 89.3 FM, streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm Matthew Law Middleton. Our guests are Dr. Catherine Satterwhite. She's the senior epidemiologist with the Kansas City Health Department and assistant professor in the Preventative Medicine and Public Health Department at KU Medical Center. We're also joined by Joy Roberts. She's a family nurse practitioner and assistant dean at the School of Nursing here at UMKC. We're discussing how to decide when you're just too sick to go to work or school. So Kansas City, how do you decide when you should stay home? Join the conversation by calling 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or you can email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. Go take a call now from Mary. Mary and Lenexa, welcome to Central Standard.
Yes, I have a couple of questions, and I also want to make a couple of points. Being a senior citizen, I see this from both a healthcare standpoint and also from the economics of elder care right now. How much money is taken from Medicare to promote these programs? And secondly, I'd like to see a real close look at what monies go to take care of children and what monies go to take care of the elderly.
Hmm.
We're all going to die. We're going to die of something. And this preponderance of monies and work being put into saving people and having them live longer, I think is misspent money.
Hmm. Good questions, Mary. Catherine?
I hear what you're saying, and I'd like to talk about children in particular. One of the reasons we emphasize a flu shot, for instance, in both young children and in elderly adults is because if someone in that population gets the flu, they are more likely to have something bad happen. So for instance, in children, if a child gets the flu, they're more likely to develop pneumonia or end up being hospitalized. And that's also true in the elderly population. So that's one of the reasons that we really emphasize those two populations. Now, in terms of economic impact, I don't know that I can really speak to that.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly it's important in the Medicare population to emphasize something as simple as the flu shot because it reduced their overall cost by preventing hospitalizations.
Yeah, for example, you get so sick that you're bedridden, and in the process of getting bedridden, your muscles atrophy. Perhaps you're more likely to fall, which could lead to a broken hip, that kind of thing?
Sure. But mainly in thinking about the kinds of conditions that the flu could progress to, like the idea of really needing to be hospitalized for pneumonia, particularly in the elderly population. And there's just a lot of more more illnesses, more conditions that can result from what might be a relatively minor illness in a 20-year-old.
Mm-hmm. And we mentioned hand sanitizers and washing hands as a good way to help prevent the spread of disease. You know, should I be doing that? There's a part of me that feels like, oh my gosh, I should be doing it every time I touch a keyboard or I touch a doorknob. When is too much too much?
There are some studies that have, as I understand, been coming out of areas like Japan that have shown that they have had some overuse of hand sanitizers. And of course, we shouldn't think that by use of hand sanitizers, we're going to kill off every virus and bacteria that is out there and might be on us, because we actually do need to be having some exposure to them in order to build up our resistance. However, washing hands on a regular basis, particularly after you touch your ears, eyes, nose, mouth, that helps reduce the contaminants on your hands. And then when you go shaking hands with someone or opening the door, and then someone comes right behind you and they open that door and then they stick their hands in their eyes, nose, and mouth, the use of hand sanitizers helps to limit that to some extent. But you don't have to act like you're obsessed.
Yeah. And you mentioned eyes, ears, nose, mouth. Mm-hmm. We avoid those areas because that's where our mucous membranes are located, right?
Essentially, yes. And that's where the eyes, nose, and mouth is where we are going to shed the viruses from and then transmit them. Ears, well, I threw that in because no one should stick anything in their ears.
Yeah, Catherine.
I agree with Joy. I think that it's important to remember, first of all, that soap and water, like the good old-fashioned soap and water, it's the best. A lot of people
antibacterial
use
soap or just
normal
soap.
Just like a bar of soap or any soap. It doesn't have to be antibacterial. In fact, regular soap is just as good. Antibacterial is a little bit of a marketing thing.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the best. So wash your hands with soap and water. Wash them for 20 seconds. I think they usually say sing the ABCs two times.
I've also heard happy birthday.
Oh, yes. Yes, happy birthday. That would work. There's really no substitute for that. We use hand sanitizer when we can't get to soap and water. So the times when you might want to think about hand sanitizer in the workplace, if you know you're sick and you've decided to go to work, keep some hand sanitizer on your desk. You know, that's, again, to just prevent from exposing other people. If there's a lot of people sick in your office, you might have some on your desk. And just do it every once in a while. And the important thing to remember, too, especially about soap and water, you get everything off, just use a little lotion. I mean, sometimes people complain of dry hands. So.
Yeah, my mother's a nurse practitioner, and, she has the most dry hands from seeing patients, you know, all the day. You know, you touch a patient, you wash your hands. You touch another patient, you wash your hands. It can be pretty brutal.
It's a lot of hand washing.
Yeah. We mentioned earlier the studies in Japan that suggest perhaps overuse. And we do hear stories about, you know, super bacteria or serious staph infections, particularly at hospitals, some of the cleanest places. How much of a concern is this for you, Catherine, in the work that you do?
So it's obviously a tremendous concern and across all medical fields and across a lot of community interests. It's a big concern, and there's a couple things I want to point out. First, washing your hands with soap and water will get rid of those bugs if they're on your hands. So it's just, I don't want to overemphasize the importance of it, but it's a common sense thing that we need to do. In terms of sort of public health importance of what we call the superbugs,
mm-hmm.
One important thing that we encourage the public to do to sort of address this problem is to know when antibiotics are appropriate. So a lot of times you're feeling sick, you go to your doctor and you want something. You want something to take to feel better. It's called a placebo. You're convinced that anything. And so we usually look for antibiotics. And we are trying to encourage, as a public health community, physicians to really be aware of when it's appropriate to prescribe and when it's not, and to try to communicate with their patients why that's true.
Mm-hmm.
So we've been talking about influenza and the common cold a lot. Those are both viral illnesses. And when you have either of those illnesses, you really don't need antibiotics. Are there times when you get a secondary infection or a secondary problem where you might need that? Yes, that's true. But in general, you do not need antibiotics for a cold or the flu.
Okay, great. And then, so let's say, just by my best efforts, I've fallen sick and I'm staying home, feeling under the weather. Are there certain things I should avoid, such as exercise? What kind of behaviors regarding to that? Joy?
You would likely feel best if you did not exercise. And I know many people are daily exercisers, and good for them, because we want them to do that. But when you are ill, we want your body to be able to use all its energy in getting better. So if you could miss a day or two of your sweaty, heart-pounding exercise that you do, and instead drink plenty of liquids and take over-the-counter cold preparations, decongestants, some Tylenol or ibuprofen for your aches and fevers, and eat what you feel like eating, but making sure you get plenty to drink.
Why always that emphasis on hydrate, hydrate, hydrate? And I mean, like, because what's happening in your body is you're just producing a lot more white blood cells, right?
You're with a cold in particular, you're producing a lot of extra mucus, and that's some moisture leaving your body. And so people tend to, or at least Americans, tend to perhaps not drink quite as much in the liquids department as they should. So, yes, and I see you do have your water there with you, and everybody should do that when they're sick, because it helps to rehydrate you. It thins those mucus secretions that you have, so you're not coughing as much. Perhaps your nose, it doesn't seem so full or so runny. And overall, if you have a fever, you're going to be losing some fluid there too, because you're hotter than normal.
Yeah, Catherine.
Another kind of silver lining about a fever to remember. So sometimes when you have a fever, you're feeling pretty crummy. But a fever is your body fighting an infection. So sometimes we think of a fever as really bad, but you have to remember that's your body responding to that infection and fighting it off. That's your body doing its job.
Why do we get fevers?
Because it elevates your core temperature when you're getting that immune response, and that is actually your immune system fighting against that infection.
Joy.
One thing I tell patients when they have a fever, I give it the analogy of your body wants to get rid of that virus or bacteria, so it's going to make the environment for it inhospitable. It's going to cook it so it leaves.
All right. Nick writes us in an email. I think it's important to remember that there are many, many people, myself included, who are hourly employees who don't get sick days. Worst of all, many of the service positions that may get to the most contact with the general population. What is your suggestion for those of us in this type of situation?
If you feel like, and that's certainly a great point, and I think there are probably some additional considerations that need to be taken. If you feel like from an economic standpoint that you really have to go to work, that you would love to stay home and you would love to be able to heal, but economically, professionally, you just can't. It's very important to do all the things that Joy said. Still, you can still hydrate. You can still take any opportunity, especially when you're not on the job, to maybe rest a little bit extra. But you also need to recognize that you are maybe the source of infection for other people. So you need to be extra careful to, for instance, cover your cough or sneeze. Just take an extra second to maybe cough in your elbow, which is not a natural motion. But that's one thing that's really, you don't have a tissue available. Cough in your elbow. You're not coughing on your hands and risking sort of that direct contact of exposure. Mm-hmm. So think about how you can protect other people in addition to doing the best you can to maintain your own health.
Mm-hmm. And we're going to go take a little bit of a step back. David has a question about flu shots. David, welcome to Central Standard.
Hi. I hear that there are two types of flu shots, a regular flu shot and a high potency flu shot. And I was wondering if your guest could give us some insights on the pros and cons of getting the high potency flu shot, why it is available, and any other insights that they might have.
Thank you, David. Catherine?
Sure. So I think the flu shot you're talking about, this high potency flu shot, is generally recommended for elderly adults. I don't think that, my impression is that it is not really something that we encourage the general population to use. The general flu shot is fine for everybody under the age of 65, and I think it's 65 and over where we think about the option of having the high potency flu shot. The reason that they have that is to address some of the concerns that I mentioned earlier, in that the risk of complications from the flu is a lot greater in that older population.
Great. And so other behaviors that, you know, people do when they're sick. I still kissed my loved ones. Should I not do that? Should I just relegate myself to an island of solitude and no affection, Joy?
I wouldn't say you should be on the island of solitude, but it might be better to actually say, I would love to give you a kiss, but I have cooties, and so I'm going to keep them to myself so my family members and my loved ones don't become ill, too. Same with shaking hands. If you've been ill when you're at work, say, and where you would normally shake hands, you can say, I have a cold, so I'm not going to shake hands. I don't want to pass it to you.
And to use my example, like, I'm feeling, again, 90, 95%. Am I still contagious? How do I tell when I'm contagious? That seems to be, like, the hardest thing for me to conceptualize.
That is a difficult thing. In general, you're most contagious earliest in your illness.
Right when you don't feel sick.
When you don't necessarily feel sick. So that's a little bit of a bummer. We generally recommend that adults, for instance, stay home until their fever has been gone for 24 hours. So that's a general guideline of contagiousness. It's not perfect, but it's something that you could use just as kind of a back of the envelope idea to gauge your contagiousness.
And what about that idea of, I've heard this before, like viral load, and I may be using the term out of context or inappropriately, so correct me if I am, but the idea that, you know, I'm living with a family and, you know, I get sick, I give it to, you know, son or daughter, I get better, they get worse, and then I, like, catch it again, or the viral load is, like, intensified because there's so many people in close contact with each other. Is that a thing, or am I misrepresenting?
So viral load is generally used in the context of HIV, but you know, we can run with it here.
Yeah.
And usually when
which
we hear about,
you're not giving to your family,
right? Which hopefully you're not, you know, coughing on them and getting. Yeah. So when we think about, you kind of hear it. Well, we pass it around our household. Yeah. And we keep. Usually, it's a different thing. Usually you get one bug and then it goes away, because even though you don't necessarily have immunity from all the common cold types forever, you will have a short-term immunity. So it's unlikely that if your daughter gets sick that they're going to give you back the same thing you gave them. Like I said, colds are pretty common this time of year, so it's not necessarily that you're passing it back and forth, but you might want to take some extra precautions at home.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And I'll chime in with, we do see this in families, particularly with young children, particularly children who are early school age or daycare, because those children are exposed to other children who get all sorts of colds and the like. They give them to your children bring them home and pass them on to you. So it can seem initially as though you keep getting the same thing, but you are actually getting new illnesses.
Great. Another question is, a lot of parents have to stay home to care for their sick children when they're not sick. What are some of the things you can do when you're being the care provider for your family to help try to minimize the risk of you also getting infected? Joy.
And the number one thing, again, is washing your hands and being very careful there in terms of, you know, sometimes people forget when they go and help their little one blow his nose or something like that. And then they go and throw the tissue away. But then maybe they decide they're going to go have a cigarette and they put their hands right up to their mouths, which I have seen happen to people many times. Or they suddenly are distracted helping their child do something else. And next thing they decide they're going to eat some crackers or something like that. And they put their hands in their mouth again. So very careful hand washing. It's certainly fine to hold your child, but you might hold them to where they're facing away from you if they're coughing. And wash your child's hands as well, because especially with little ones, they want to put their hands on your face all the time.
I've seen it both ways. Starve a cold, feed a fever, starve a cold. Good goodness. Like, How do I know what to do? Catherine?
So I think this goes back to what Joy said earlier. No matter if you're sick, regardless if you have the cold or the flu, drink water, use good health habits, cover your cough, wash your hands, get rest when you need to get rest, eat when you're hungry. I don't think that there's...
And don't eat when you're not hungry.
Nauseous. Right. I think your body is pretty smart, and I think part of getting well is listening to your body. And if that means staying at home from work to rest, then that's what you need to do.
Okay. Well, I'm so sorry we're out of time for this segment, but I want to thank you, both of you, Dr. Catherine Satterwhite. She's the senior epidemiologist with the Kansas City Health Department and associate professor in the Preventative Medicine and Public Health Department at KU Medical Center. Thank you, Catherine, for sharing your time with us today. And Joy Roberts, she's a family nurse practitioner and assistant dean at the School of Nursing here at UMKC. Thank you, Joy.
Thank you.
We're going to take a short break, and when we return, we'll be discussing the many ambitious incentive plans that Missouri and Kansas are using to court Boeing. Central Standard returns in just a moment.